From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. If you go to my next guest's webpage, you'll see that she's an award-winning journalist and an author of 6 true crime books. She's got into the fiction realm. We've talked about the book Singularity, and come July 21st, Bloodlines will be released. Catherine Casey is here. And why I wanted to bring Catherine on, not only to talk about her books, is I was cruising the Internet the other day, which I do now and then, and I came across the fine blog Women in Crime. And I saw an article by my friend Catherine talking about Susan Atkins. You'll know Susan Atkins is one of Charles Manson's gang, and she's up for parole again with a question mark. And it's always a pleasure to have Catherine on the show. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Dana. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, I think you and I even talked about this the first time. Susan Atkins, a brain tumor or some sort of cancer, I believe. And we talked about the whole compassionate issue when it came to her case. We all know about Charles Manson and his gang and the terror that they brought upon Los Angeles in the late 1960s. But I thought this article was very interesting on, again, Women in Crime. And if you're interested in that blog, go to womenincrimeinc.blogspot.com. Tell us about the article that you wrote on the 18th of June.
Well, I was questioning last May, in May 2008, I wrote an article for the blog. Mm-hmm. And at that point, Susan Atkins had been given 6 months to live by the prison doctors. And she had applied for compassionate release, and that was denied in July of 08. And we heard a lot at that time about what dire condition she was in and how she was expected to die at any moment, pretty much. And then all of a sudden, it turns out this year that she's not only still alive, but she's up for parole again. She was supposed to go before the board in May. That hearing was postponed until September, so now she's up for another parole hearing this September. I didn't quite understand how she'd survived for so long. Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of amazed at this, and I was wondering if we had been given the whole story a year earlier.
You know, and I think you make a good point, and from the media coverage I've seen of it, and her story, I thought that it was quite clear as far as the medical aspect, and I'm not sure if, and by no means am I a doctor or profess to have any medical expertise, but you would think with a brain tumor, one where you're given 6 months to live, that progressively you would get worse and worse, and I'm not sure if she was being treated at all. But there's a bigger aspect than just Susan Atkins. It's this whole compassionate idea when it comes to release from prison. A lot say a life sentence is a life sentence. You're there till you die. Yet there are some that say, for compassionate reasons, we should let them out. But you have to wonder where Susan Atkins' compassion was when she was committing her crimes.
Well, you know, this is really a tough question. It truly is. She was actually, along with Manson and the others, given the death penalty originally.
Right.
And that was commuted at one point, and at that point they didn't have life without parole. So, you know, down the road, that made her eligible for parole. And certainly, you know, she showed no mercy to Sharon Tate or the other victims. You know, Susan was the one who held Sharon while she was being stabbed. And I think, actually, didn't she say that she would participate, that she was one of those who was stabbing Sharon while Sharon was begging for mercy?
I believe so. And it's... you know, I'm going to share a comment from the blog, and I'm not going to identify the person who wrote the comment, and we'll kind of go from one side to the next. It says, "Oh, for God's sake, Susan Atkins isn't a threat to anyone anymore. She didn't kill Sharon Tate. That was jailhouse bragging. Even Charles Watson admits to killing Sharon Tate. Well, anyone that's followed the case know that they've all admitted and denied several times in this, and, mm-hmm. and the evidence does point towards it. It says, I understand Deborah's vigilance, and that is Sharon Tate's sister, I believe, in this case. I don't agree with it. I think the three Manson girls who have all spent... or who have spent all these decades in prison, have learned their lessons. Now, someone like that ding-a-ling Squeaky Fromm should be in prison for the rest of their life, if you ask me. Now, Squeaky Fromm, another one of Manson's cohorts, ended up taking a shot at President Ford, I believe. Looking at this, ding-a-ling aside, learning their lesson, do you ever learn your lesson when you have committed a crime or have been convicted of a crime like this? You know, from the perspective of an author and someone who's followed crime for a long time, and I'm not trying to be a poet here, these sorts of cases, learning their lesson seems like kind of a naive comment. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it is, and I think on the other hand, that is that really why she's there at this point? I mean, this is someone who participated in brutal serial killings over a period of time. And are we going to start letting people like that out of the prisons? I mean, is that something that, do we want to set a precedent?
Well, no, exactly. And where do you draw the line when it comes to this? Mm-hmm. We've all seen, and I'm sure you have, Charles Manson, when he's come forward for his parole hearings, some of them are, well, I don't find it funny. I find it a wake-up call for those out there that don't think people like Charles Manson exist. Now, let's go to the other side of some of the comments on this blog that you've written. And it says, again, I'll not identify the person who wrote it. It says, great post as usual, Catherine, as they should have all gotten the death penalty for the murders. They got it pretty good, well, a great deal with life in prison. Though prison is probably a little okay, a lot worse than being out here. So it goes from death penalty to, it's okay, they've learned their lesson, let's just leave them alone. I think it is fascinating, not only the medical aspect of it, Catherine, but the fact that the public, even all these years later, you know, 1968 and here we are in 2009, and we're still thinking about this case. This case has been written about and talked about in movies and you name it, and we'll probably keep talking about it. Is this one of these cases that will, you know, 30, 40 years from now when you and I are gone, will they still be talking about?
Well, I'm sure it is. It really kind of stole our innocence, don't you think? I mean, these killings along with Ted Bundy's crime mm-hmm. and Richard's back up in Chicago, those were really the... I think at that point we became aware of serial killings and the whole thing in Hollywood, the glamour that this was attached to with Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. And I'm sure that we'll be talking about these the rest of our lifetimes, and I'm sure our children will.
Now, if you're just tuning in, author Catherine Casey is here, and we're talking about her recent blog article about Susan Atkins and her new book coming out, Bloodlines. More information in the show notes or go to her webpage, CatherineCasey.com. Catherine is spelled with a K. In a movie the other day, and I happened to see a preview for a new John Dillinger movie coming out. Johnny Depp, I believe, is going to play Dillinger. And when we look at that movie, and again, I'm maybe commenting unfairly here because I've only seen the trailer, but researching it a little bit, it almost looks like here we go again. We're going to be glorifying Joker in Batman. We're going to be glorifying a villain, and there are going to be kids out there and people out there that are going to think that John Dillinger was a hero. What are we doing with society today? Am I wrong? Is society starting to look at these guys, and they're trying to do what they can to you know, make money off them, that maybe John Dillinger wasn't all that bad, he was just a bank robber?
Well, you know, I mean, we had, and don't misunderstand me, I watched The Sopranos and enjoyed mm-hmm. the series, but certainly that glorified the mafia.
Yep.
You know, I think we have a long history of this, and I don't know if it's any worse today than it was, it probably is, I guess, than it was in the past, although... Even at the time that the crimes were being committed, if correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't there little dime books and everything being written about Dillinger that glorified him at the time?
And it's I consider it sick and twisted, and now Hollywood is coming out. There was the San Francisco serial killer here a ways back, a few years ago, that they were talking about the movie, and all of a sudden, and again, Joker, and now when you look at Dillinger, it just turns my stomach a little bit, and we know that in today's society, I think when you were young and when I was young, we wouldn't have been allowed to go see a movie like that. In fact, it would be difficult for us to hear about it, but today, parents, whether it's with the video games or what's on television, of course, the internet, which we're using today on these movies, this stuff is pretty much wide open, and there's a lot of impressionable young people out there.
Yeah, I've been in movies. I saw with it was a serial killer movie a while back, and there was a little family in front of me with toddlers, and I was just absolutely appalled. I couldn't believe that they were there. And afterward, I actually kind of cornered the manager and complained, and he told me that if they were with their parents, there wasn't anything you could do to keep them out.
That's unbelievable.
But it was so sad.
That's unbelievable. Catherine Casey is here, and I want to get into Bloodlines a little bit. I believe available July 21st. Tell us about it.
It's the sequel to Singularity. My main character is Sarah Armstrong. She's a Texas Ranger profiler who's stationed in Company A here in Houston. And in Bloodlines, it's kind of a dual plot. There's a suicide that an apparent suicide that she quickly decides maybe wasn't a suicide of a very wealthy oil executive. And the second line is kind of a Britney Spears kind of character or a Miley Cyrus. It's a young teenage superstar who's being stalked. And she's coming to Houston for the rodeo, and Sarah has to move in and protect her and find the stalker.
It's when you write books like that, and you, I guess to make it simple, how do you come up with those ideas? I think it's fantastic.
Well, you know, I've been covering crime for 25 years. I did it for magazines for a long time, and then I started writing the true crime books. So I've spent an awful lot of time talking to police officers and, detectives and prosecutors and defense attorneys, and I guess I've just gotten around a lot. I always go to the trials for my true crime books, and they'll go on for weeks at a time, and I'll hear the forensic guys testify, and, you know, I go through all the documents. So I've got all these stories in my head after 25 years and all of these characters, and nothing in this book is based, you know, on a particular case I followed, but I've got little elements of different cases I've run across over the years. And then, it is true. You hear novelists say that the characters take over in a novel, and they really do. They kind of move in and show you where the book is going at a certain point.
They say that songwriters will come up with an idea, Catherine, in the middle of the night, and they'll jot it down on a napkin or on the back of a business card. Is that true for authors?
Sometimes, sometimes that does happen, Dana. I'll be driving down the street and I'll think, oh, I know how that's supposed to end. I'll have to pull over, though, before I write anything down.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. Author Catherine Casey is here, and you can go to her webpage by going to www.catherinecasey.com. We've talked about this before, Catherine, the high-profile cases in the news, Peterson, Anthony, you name it. What do you like better? Do you like the true crime, the nonfiction versus the fiction, or vice versa?
Well, I'm enjoying the fiction right now after so many years of writing nonfiction. It's actually rather nice, not to have real victims. And, you know, when someone dies in one of my novels, it's not a real person. No one really grieves for them. And it gets a little hard being a true crime writer over a lot of years. Because you do talk to a lot of victims' families.
especially with a case like Anthony, for example, it's nowhere close to being done, and who knows when it will finish, but it just seems like it's the Energizer Bunny. It keeps going and going and going.
Well, you really, you know, I tend not to do crimes that involve children.
Right.
Simply because I don't like those memories. And I do think that they're awfully hard on the writer when you follow a case like that over a period of really years. I have a couple of them that I did that took years, and there's quite an expenditure not only in time, but just in you know, kind of personal investment. So, I'm enjoying the fiction right now. I am still doing true crime. I have a true crime book coming out next year. I'm not planning to walk away from that.
Mm-hmm. When you look at a mystery, as an author writing about mysteries and true crime, do you consider yourself kind of a mystery detective yourself?
Well, a little bit, and then sometimes I get stumped. And the really nice thing about 25 years as a crime reporter is I know who to call to get help.
Yeah.
So I had a little problem. I'm finishing a book. It's the third in the Armstrong series. It's called The Crossroads. And I had a little bit of a problem, so I called up a friend who's a homicide detective and took her to where my book is ending and explained what was going on and had her tell me what she would do. So it's wonderful to have friends.
Resources are fantastic. Author Catherine Casey is here. We're talking about her new book coming out, Bloodlines, and the Women in Crime blog. Let's talk about the blog a little bit. You've been part of it since day one. How great is it to have a resource of all the gals that are on there, different opinions, different thoughts, different stories?
It's just so much fun. Everybody comes from a different place. Everybody has a little different expertise. We all often we don't always agree on things. We disagree quite often. Pat Brown and I have had some lively discussions over the years.
I'll bet.
It's just really a lot of fun. And it's an outlet for those cases that you want to weigh in on, like I did on this Atkins case. It's not the commitment of writing a book, but I got to say what I was thinking about it.
And I think that's so important, is sharing thoughts and sharing ideas. And is there ever a story that runs out of fodder, I guess? Like Charles Manson, I'm sure there will be stories that you can tell that maybe people haven't heard, or subplots, I guess, to use that term, for decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the big cases do tend to live on. Now, at a certain point, when I pick cases for my true crime books, I don't usually do the big cases, because I think we get so inundated with those on a daily basis that they hold less interest, I think, as time passes. But some of them become legendary, like Bundy and like the Manson case. I don't know if the Peterson case would be like that. Do you think it will, Dana?
That's hard to say. That case, Drew Peterson, has gone. Of course, we could talk about Scott Peterson. That'd be a whole different show. But the Drew Peterson case has gone from a tragedy, or two tragedies, to almost a raping of the media by allowing Mr. Peterson to come on and not only just say his story. I believe everyone has a right to their opinion, but it became almost a joke after a while, where he would come on and talk about dating contests and all of that. So it made a mockery of the system. So I think that will turn this a little bit. It may not be that big of a story after a while. A tragic story, yes, but I think Drew Peterson, and whether he's convicted or not, will eventually blow off into the wind. But that's just my opinion.
Well, I tend to agree. It has this real circus atmosphere at this point, and it's gotten to the point it's actually kind of uncomfortable seeing him on television.
Well, I've had Drew Peterson on my program and talked to him, and I found it somewhat uncomfortable talking to him. But again, I believe everyone has a right to voice their opinion and to say what they have to say. But when it became a joke to him, and personalities aside, it became a little bit difficult. I'll still bring his lawyer on and talk to him about the case. But as far as Drew Peterson, I think he needs to worry about his life and not worry about comedic career, or whatever you want to call it. Just, I'm going to give you the last word, Catherine. The book Shattered is going to be coming out in August 2010. Let's do 30 seconds on that.
Well, that's actually kind of a Scott Peterson case, only it predates that. It was here in Houston, and it took 9 years to bring that case to trial. It's just a fascinating case, a real heartbreaker.
Well, and these stories, they're not done in a day or two. Like you say, it takes 10 years. And will we see that with Drew Peterson and Cindy Anthony? Casey Anthony. It's hard to say, but even Cindy, the mom, will be a big part of it for a long time to come. Catherine, Casey, thank you. You're always welcome on the program.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to take a break. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be back with famed forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht and crime author Donna Kaufman. Of course, you know their book, A Question of Murder. And we're going to talk about the Kaylee Anthony autopsy. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkey Radio. You'll know my next guest, forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht and crime author Donna Kaufman. Their book, A Question of Murder, we've discussed several times here on the program. I'm pleased to have them both back on the air today to talk a little bit about the Anthony autopsy and some other high-profile cases in the news. Good evening.
Good evening.
Hello.
Hi, Donna. Dr. Wecht, start with you. I've said it several times on the show, and I believe you and I have even discussed it here. Florida is a unique state when it comes to sharing discovery with the people. We've seen thousands, if not tens of thousands, of documents in this Anthony case, young Kaylee Anthony and her mom, Casey, allegedly taking her life. The autopsy became a big issue. It's been released now, 35 or 36 pages, depends what news organization you listen to. Was it that big of a deal for the family to try and block it, or is it something that you think the public really needed to know?
Well, I don't think it's such a big deal as to have required the family to block it. Sooner or later, it's going to come out.
Exactly.
Also, I think that what we had learned from the news media reports about first the girl missing and the search that went on for several months, and then finally the discovery of the body. So really, you know, you don't have to be a forensic pathologist to have kind of expected what came forward. And most of the report is rather technical. Nobody's going to be interested in the length of the radius or the ulna or how they go about determining from bone measurements what the age of the child was. These are things that people have taken for granted. And so far as whether the public has a right to know, you know, that's another matter. It depends, I guess, on the perspective. I think in this particular case, for the reasons that I've already expressed, it really was of no great consequence. Nothing has been lost. I don't think either side has been damaged by the release of the report. It's just, you know, something that everybody had come to understand, and anybody who had an interest in the case has not been, I think, the least bit surprised by these findings.
Donna Kaufman, crime author. Well, when you look at, and I started off with Dr. Wecht by talking about Florida, when you look at a state of Florida and the Anthony case compared to Illinois and the Peterson case, the comparison of the two is, well, you can't compare the two. Florida must be a dream when it comes to an author looking at gaining information and evidence for her book or his book.
Yes, I'd very much like to see the most recent Drew Peterson case autopsies. But Florida is great. They do hold back on interpreting the information. That will be the experts doing so on the stand. But all the information, if you can read through the medicalese and get a sense of what happened, it's all very damning, I think, for the defense. This autopsy was so amazing. The comprehensiveness of the investigation. They set up camp in that dump site for 8 days and found every tooth in that child's mouth except one.
They found almost every bone in her body. The search was so extensive, and they break it down, and the forensic report from the Oak Ridge Laboratory answers all the potential landmines that the defense is going to bring up, such as mom said, oh, it was pizza in the car that had maggots. Well, they got two cars that were similar from a junkyard, and they put pizza in pepperoni pizza in the trunk for several days. They didn't get maggots. They put Lee Anthony was saying, oh, as Casey said, she ran over a squirrel. So they got a dead squirrel in Tennessee, and they put it in the trunk. They didn't get those smells. They broke down the scents of all the essences in that trunk, and they found out that there was a higher degree of chloroform than any other way they could reproduce it, including the death of a three-year-old child in Montana some years before, who was wrapped in a blanket and stuck in a trunk for 3 months. That kid did not give off decomp that was chloroform to the levels that were in Casey's car. So good luck, those defense team members. Good luck.
Dr. Cyril Wecht, being no stranger to being attacked in the media as you have been in the past, I believe Dr. G in this case and the investigators have done a very good job. They've stayed away from the media. They've let the media do the talking themselves, and the defense, how you can interpret that one way or the other. But I'm curious your thoughts on the autopsy itself and the, I believe, good work done by that organization.
Yes, it's a very thorough, detailed, excellent job. They spent an inordinate amount of time. And as a matter of fact, you know, if there's any criticism, so to speak, that might be made, it would be, hey, all the resources, and this has to have gone into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, mm-hmm. and thousands and thousands of person hours in working on this. When you think of how many homicides there are, and including, regrettably, tragically, children and so on, it's just that the news media had made the Anthony case very special. Has that happened with JonBenet Ramsey? Has that happened with Lacey Peterson? Because if you do look at those cases, you know, it just is a kind of a case in a particular category or so on. I assure you that kind of case is occurring every week. I was tempted to say every day. Let's just say every week somewhere in America, something that comes very, very close. But certain cases develop it's a magic. It's a mystique. It's something that the news media generates. But the autopsy is thorough. And a point that Donna made is very, very important, and it bears a repeat emphasis, and that is that it is not something that should be discussed in terms of the interpretations and the opinions to be expressed at trial. That is a quite different matter. This is a report that is objective, and the only thing that is subjective is the ultimate determination, in which Dr. Garavaglia says that she considers it to be a homicide, even though the exact cause of death and the mechanism of death cannot be determined. And here I want to say that this case, in that respect, is on all fours with Lacey Peterson. In Lacey Peterson case,
right.
Number one, no cause of death. Number two, no mechanism of death. Number three, the exact place and time of death never determined. And and also it bears another very, very identical component, and that is that in both cases the defendant, at least so far with Casey Anthony, the mother here, as it was with Scott Peterson, never acknowledged that he had killed his wife, and so far Casey Anthony has never said that she did anything to her child, and not only killed, but caused the death of. There's a difference. Killed is homicide. You can cause the death of, or you may cover up. There's a tragic accident, and maybe if Scott Peterson had said from day one, hey, she fell down the steps. Maybe if Casey Anthony had said, hey, I left the child in the car and it got hot, I came back and she had suffocated. Whatever. But these cases bear a striking resemblance to each other in terms of those particular issues. So the point, and this may be something that you want to talk about, Don and I had talked about it before, about some people out there involved in the case and maybe close friends and self-appointed allies of those involved in the case are saying, gee, they don't see anything that would suggest a homicide here. My God, that is carrying naivete to a point of absurdity.
Absolutely. Forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht is here, crime author Donna Kaufman. Donna, the cameras, the lights, the glitz, the interviews, whether it's Geraldo or Nancy Grace or Greta or whoever, all of a sudden you get asked questions. You say things that you shouldn't say. You say dumb things, in fact, that may look at the case or be affecting the case in time. Has this case, the Anthony case, been too, and this isn't even a word, but I'm going to call it glitzified, well, maybe it is, I don't know, where there's been too much Hollywood and some people with some credentials have made fools of themselves?
You know, I say let them talk. It's always more interesting, and that's part of what intrigues viewers and readers and listeners, and let them talk. Who cares? But I will say that just to add two things to what Dr. Weck just said, one is that the defense seems to be putting every hope into judicial rulings that will go in their favor, such as getting the chloroform computer searches that date back to April discounted, which would take off perhaps the death penalty if they're not allowed in.
Right.
I think they will be allowed in. And secondly, just to plug our book again, A Question of Murder, we have the case of Danielle Van Dam in there. She was found 22 days, I think, after her body, after she was kidnapped. Her body was left in the desert, desiccated, mummified, and almost unbelievably posed. And it's just a very tragic case. But no cause of death there. They couldn't prove that he raped her, although there was certainly evidence to suggest that he was never charged with that. And that guy is sitting on death row now playing pinochle with Scott Peterson.
Jeez, that's unbelievable. Dr. Cyril Wecht, some would say that the defense in this case is grasping for straws. They have a big area. They're digging holes, and they're hoping in these holes that they're going to find something to try and save their client. Do you see it that way?
Well, look, I have no problem with a defense attorney doing everything that he can in behalf of his client. But I really do believe, quite frankly, that they made a big mistake here by for whatever reason, unless maybe the client is totally, totally recalcitrant, maybe even has suppressed everything to the point that she doesn't really know herself what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But what happens when attorneys get involved in, quite frankly, is that they are captured by, as you say, the cling lights, the glamour, and you don't get cases like this every day. Even the big shots, when F. Lee Bailey was around, and Jerry Spence, and and now Mark Yargos and Racehorse Haynes, and you name it. And when you get an attorney that has never had a case like this and probably never will have a case like this again, they're going to play it for all it's worth. And I'm not suggesting anything unethical, but I'm suggesting, I think, maybe bad judgment. And for people in this particular case, when you have a 2-year, 10-month-old child who is missing for a whole month, and the mother doesn't tell the parents, her parents, the grandparents of the missing child, and the grandparents whose house the grandchild resides in, lives in, and they don't press it, and then you have the body being found, what, about 4 months later, and it is decomposed, and there is duct tape around the mouth so tight that it holds the lower jaw, the mandible, to the top of the skull. It would ordinarily fall apart, of course, when all the soft tissues decomposed because there are no bony attachments, and you got the duct tape, and then you got people out there, including a forensic scientific academician in New York City, whose name I will not mention, and then you've got other forensic pathologists. And one thing I don't understand, and maybe Donna can shed some light on this, a forensic pathologist who was involved in the case. I was astounded to see him speaking on a television program yesterday morning. I thought that you're not supposed to. I would never do that.
Was that gag order?
When I was involved, even without a gag order,
yeah.
unless the attorney told me to do it. I mean, told me not what to say, but told me it's okay to go ahead and express your opinions, and there's no gag order. In that case, fine. I'll go and express my opinions if the attorney wants me to. Even then, I'll not be happy about it. But I don't need a gag order to make me understand that I don't go shooting my mouth off in advance of a trial. I was just absolutely astounded. And I think just some people have been, I don't know what has captured them in this case, but it's just unfathomable.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. It's bizarre. It's like a family reunion with the crazy uncle who's you got your husband and wife, and all of a sudden you got the crying judge from another case that comes in to talk, and you get somebody else in there. And I think, my God, even Ann Coulter, the right-wing nut, was on there talking about this case too. And I have to wonder where the producers are going with this. Have they not? Have they not looked at it in the mirror to see just how foolish they're looking? Because this is it's getting to be like a bad TV movie. Unfortunately, the tragedy is the little girl that died, and it's getting away from that. Donna.
Well, our book has a great section on the crying judge, Larry Seidlin, because we cover the Anna Nicole and her son cases. So if you want a laugh and to wonder how is this guy keeping his law license, have a read at page 136. But one of the things that I think is going to happen, I think that they can't do anything. If Casey Anthony, like Phil Spector, won't take any degree of blame, what else is the defense going to do but try to find, you know, some place to get in and out for defense in spite of it? She won't plea out.
Right.
But right now, the prosecutors in the case want a trial date set for her fraud case within 60 days. And I think this is to kind of put this woman in the courtroom where this is because she ripped off her friend, her best friend. She cleaned out her bank account when she had access to it. And it's only, for $400-$500. I mean, it's a small amount of money. But they're going to put her on the stand, and people who know her, including possibly her parents, are going to get up there and talk about what a thief she is. Her own people that she's depending to be there for her as character witnesses, one after the other, are going to come to court, swear on a Bible, and trash her. And she's going to get a taste of what it's going to be like in June when the case should go to trial, her murder case.
Dr. Cyril Wecht and Donna Kaufman are here. You'll know them as the co-authors of a book, A Question of Murder. Dr. Wecht, I'll give you the last word and ask you this question. You can have the family reunions, the crying judges, the right-wing political commentator, everyone on earth talking about the case on TV, but when it boils down to it, forensics are forensics. Evidence, putting a case together is like putting a puzzle together. You may not have all the pieces, but you do the best you can. What's going to win, and what's going to be the deciding factor in this case eventually?
Well, your question contains the answer. It's an excellent summation that you just gave. It is going to be the forensic evidence, and there is one thing that is contained in all of our discussion this evening, but it bears emphasis and isolation. And that is, and I can tell you, 47 years in this business, when you come into court and you have a child, an infant, that is dead, it's a lot different than any other case involving an adult. A jury finds it almost impossible, in my experience, to walk away without having either a guilty verdict or a darn good explanation that they can live with. They can live with all kinds of cockamamie explanations in all kinds of cases, especially, you see, if the decedent is someone whose reputation wasn't so great and was further tarnished in the courtroom proceedings. When you have a child less than 3 years old dead and they're going to show some of those pictures that we've all seen on television of the little girl, what a beautiful little girl. I guarantee you that jury is not going to walk out of there accepting some cockamamie thing like, gee, you know, well, we don't know who did it, and we don't know where she was, and she might have died accidentally, and so on. That's right. She went off with a boyfriend, and he did her in, or she went to, she decided to go hiking that day, and she inadvertently fell into a swamp. Come on, you know, forget about it. It's too late now. The attorneys have not done Casey Anthony any favors by going along with this. With this kind of approach.
I agree. The Casey/Kaylee Anthony story is far from over. Thank you both for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye. Thank you very much, Dan.
Okay, bye-bye. That's famed forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht and crime author Donna Kaufman. And this story is far from over, whether it's Casey, Kaylee, poor little Kaylee, Cindy, George, Lee, you name it. It's a story that will... have a lot more chapters and a lot more pages to be told. I'm going to be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio with ADA Robin Sachs with her weekly segment, Nothing But the Sachs. It's going to be interesting to see Robin's thoughts on the Chris Brown Rihanna case, on this case and others. We'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Yes, I know you heard that twice. I got to wonder, Robin Sachs is in California, and I'm trying to get a hold of her when I phone her number. It sounds like someone plucking a banjo that's badly out of tune. We, you know, living in California, maybe the telephone system has gone bankrupt too, or Arnold's been spending too much money on it. We're going to, oh, just a minute. That'll be her. I love live radio. Are you there? You know, when I phoned both your numbers, and by the way, we're live right now, and it sounded like someone plucking a banjo that was really badly out of tune.
Oh, dear. Like that. You know, I was thinking that you had lost your noodles or something.
Oh, my noodles have been gone for a long time. And for those of you just tuning in, this is our favorite ADA out of Los Angeles County. She's an author. She's a radio host. And she has... a terrible phone service because I've been trying for the last 10 minutes to get a hold of her, but that could be me. It could be on my end too, but regardless, welcome, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you tonight?
Good. You got a big show on Justice Interrupted coming up tonight. Tell us who's going to be on there.
We do. We have a great show. I'm really, really looking forward to it. Tonight we have Jane Velez Mitchell joining us, and who is, I think I told you, we had the opportunity to meet her in person at Book Expo in New York. So not only do we get to talk to her and pick her brain about what it's like covering crime and how the media affects crime and all those good things that we like to talk about, but we also are going to be one of her first shows in talking about her upcoming release of her book called I Won't, which really kind of goes through her personal journey through addiction and other ailments. And really interesting kind of personal view of Jane Velez Mitchell. And then an equally impressive woman we have is a woman by the name of Lisa Cohen. And she's fantastic. She's an investigative journalist who covered, who used to work for 60 Minutes for many years.
Right.
And then was the first journalist who covered the case of Eitan. And she wrote the book After Eitan, which, as you know, Eitan Pass is all of the kind of the impetus for all of the missing cases, kidnapping cases, and really the most widely publicized kidnapping since the Lindbergh trials. So we will have her to talk about her investigation and her book that just was released about 2 weeks ago.
And, of course, Justice Interrupted can be found on Blog Talk Radio. Just go to the website. Robin Sachs, you know, Ed McMahon, one of my favorite television personalities, passed away. And a segment that he did with Johnny Carson weekly was called Karnak. And you know, they put the envelope up to the head and guess or bring the answers and try and guess the question. What do you think my first question will be to you tonight?
Ooh.
Besides just thinking, what the hell is he talking about?
Let's see, let me guess. Well, other than, the first question is, where am I?
Yeah.
Because I tend to be in different places.
Yes.
That's one of your first questions. And other than that, you're probably going to talk to me about our good friend, Drew Peterson.
No. Yes, but no. Mm. Yes, but no. Chris Brown and Rihanna.
Oh, I was, you know what? That was so, like, such a low ball. I guess I kind of didn't even think that you would even go there. You know, what can I say? I'm not really at liberty to talk about the facts or anything about the case, and I don't really know about the facts other than what everyone else knows from what I've heard on TV and media. However, it's very interesting. I know the big question out there is, did he get a sentence that is different or better than anyone else would have gotten?
Yep.
And I think that the question really comes down to an understanding, a fundamental appreciation for how the criminal justice system works. And you and I have talked about this very issue before, and that is the issue of plea bargaining.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't say, is he being treated like everyone else is treated without saying that you would look at someone's occupation, accepting the responsibility in advance, likelihood of reoffending, and factors that may have to do with the celebrity in a non-direct or indirect way. And without looking at those, it would be we'd be remiss. And so then I would be accused of saying that the celebrity does affect the outcome of a case, and of course it does, just like it would affect the outcome of a case if someone was a full-time student and their college career was at risk if they were pleading guilty to a crime, if they were in the armed services and their career was on the line, and anything else. So we do look at those things, and we also look at the likelihood of reoffending, and we also should look at the fact that, and balance it against the part that he took responsibility early. He saved the county and the state from a preliminary hearing. He saved the victim from coming into court. And I think that the factors that the DA's office looked at, which is very much what we'd look at in any case, which is why he is being treated like everybody else, is we'd look at his prior history. We'd look at his, the psychological reports, the likelihood to reoffend, as I said, and, of course, counterbalance it to the injuries caused. And the problem of the case is exactly that. The public has a sense of what the injury was by those pictures, and those pictures are awful and atrocious. And so when you look at those awful, atrocious pictures, nothing short of prison seems appropriate. However, we need to balance that with what would someone on a first time, no criminal history whatsoever, get? And what would, and more importantly, not only what he would get from what the DA's office would offer, but more importantly, what would a judge who sat during the trial give the defendant at the end of the day? And what we have to look at is what would the judge do, assuming that all 12 people convicted Chris Brown? And that's a big assumption. I mean, do I need to remind us all of O.J. Simpson? I mean, the celebrity factor is a real factor, not necessarily in the DA's office mind, but it's a real factor in jury's mind. So if you don't put that into perspective in some way, then we're being foolish. So yes and no is the answer to that question.
You know, I knew as soon as I brought that up, and I this lowball thing, I don't know about that, but you knew, and you know, the only reason I brought it up is because I'm worried. I think you're gonna get attacked, maybe even on your own show tonight, a little bit about this. And for those that don't understand the plea bargain process, they're gonna say this Hollywood so and so. Rock and roll guy. I wouldn't know a Chris Brown song from whatever. It got away because he bought his sentence. Mark Garagos, all this sort of stuff. That's why I wanted you to bring it. I brought it up and I wanted you to comment on it because, as usual, you're absolutely bang on. You said it the way it is. But how do you convince the people to understand the plea bargain process that this is no different than another case?
Well, I mean, the problem is, you know, for better or for worse, most people in society don't have an understanding of the actual inner workings of the criminal justice system. We know from what we see on television, we know about the crimes, and most of the time when we hear about the crimes, we very seldom hear about the resolution of what happened to that case unless the case goes to trial and, of course, it's in front of a camera. And then, of course, then you have the arguments that the camera affects everything again. So you get into this round catch-22 problem. So thankfully, a lot of people don't have the experience of understanding what the system is like from that point of view. So, but the idea is that it's really to take an interest and to know and to learn. I mean, we're very, I think, you know, and I've said this in a couple of my books, I forget which one at this point, but, you know, plea bargaining, you even say the word plea bargaining, and it's got negative, terrible connotations. And
yep.
You and I have talked about that, and it's just a matter of educating ourselves and looking at it through a different lens. It's, our system depends on plea bargaining, and some, you know, a plea bargain could be a plea for 50 years as opposed to a life sentence, and that could be a really good deal when the defendant's 75. So you have to look at the factors from the whole and not just, you know, draw broad strokes based on definitions and perceptions that unfortunately have been illuminated through the media's eyes and not through lawyers' eyes.
So I guessed where you are because you got such crappy cell phone reception. You're sitting on the roof of a hangar at an airport.
I know. You know what? It's so funny. I think, you know, that actually is really interesting. I live right near the federal building in Los Angeles, and every night about this time since this Iran election thing has gone on, they've been doing these protests about what's been going on in Iran. So this is just our nightly SWAT team coming in to make sure there aren't going to be any terrorist bombs. And then, of course, I've got my daughter and her friend in my office tearing it apart, who I'm bribing with candy every couple of minutes to keep it down. And then I have my really great computer tech who's here kind of putting things together in my office. And, you know, that's kind of the way it is. That's how we roll here.
You bet. And you do such a good job at it. Robin Sachs, ADA author, radio show host, you name it. Your weekly segment is always enjoyed here. And getting a hold of you is lots of fun, too. So.
Although, you know what? I'm going to stay still from now on and then just do the show from my office, and it's going to be nice and quiet from now on, but without all the tech people around. So that's going to be where you're going to catch me next time. I'll send you that number.
You know, I'm kidding, and I love you, and I'd love to have you on the show, no matter where you are.
Oh, but you get the red phone now. That's all there is to it.
All right. Good luck with the show tonight. Thanks, Robin.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, that's ADA Robin Sachs out of Los Angeles County, and it's always a challenge to figure out where she is, but it's a great segment, and we appreciate it. All right, that's tonight's show. Remember, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live. You can pick up podcasts of past shows. You can leave comments, whatever. And remember, the creme de la creme, I like to say, of blogs is at scaredmonkeys.com. Thank you all. We'll see you soon. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.